Registration is now open for ACRM 2021. Registering for our virtual annual conference gives you access to the content for over 6 months. That's over 400 hours of CME CEUs. Go to acrm.org/register to check out the growing online program and see all of our great registration options.
Welcome to the April 2021 edition of RehabCast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox of the Shepherd Center here in Atlanta, Georgia. So Atlanta is now the seventh largest media market in the nation, according to the 2021 Nielsen ranking, skyrocketing three spots up the list, even above Washington, D.C. Now, I'm just reporting the facts, and I'll leave it to our listeners to judge whether our podcast played any role in that. In all seriousness, this month's RehabCast features a couple of rehab luminaries. Dr. Linda Ehrlich-Jones of the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab helps us delve into the highs and lows of exoskeleton technology as it stands today for use by the spinal cord injury population. Then we're going to check in with John White of Moss Rehab and his work with a large team of brain injury research stalwarts on developing the Brain Injury Functional Outcome Measure. What is the BIFOM? Why do we need it? When will it be ready for use? And how does Dr. White envision us using it? Keep listening. Dr. Ehrlich-Jones, thanks for joining us today on the RehabCast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the paper that you've come to discuss with us today, and we're going to talk about some of the nature of the other work that you've done as well to start out with, but to highlight for our audience, it is Clinician Perceptions of Robotic Exoskeletons for Locomotor Training After Spinal Cord Injury. This is a qualitative study inviting therapists, clinicians primarily, who are working with patients with exoskeletons to talk about the pros and cons in frank terms and try to get some trends and analysis about how this new technology is incorporating into the rehabilitation space and what we can perhaps do better with it and where we might need to temper expectations and so forth. Maybe provide some good feedback for the exoskeleton industry, too, I would expect also. So Dr. Ehrlich-Jones, tell us a little bit about the nature of the work that you do in outcomes research and some of the things that you focused on in the past.
So a lot of the research that I do focuses on what we call behavioral interventions, so helping people to change their behavior, doing some coaching, helping people through a mechanism called motivational interviewing to help them to actually figure out what change they want to make and what goals they want to make. In addition, though, we've been doing a bit of qualitative work, which is really important in terms of helping you to get to that point to create an intervention, getting the input from the stakeholders as to what is of most importance. We do a lot of different types of research. I work with a lot of different investigators, work a lot with Alan Heineman, who works with me at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, but also with other physical therapists, with other physicians. Again, just trying to focus on what is the best way to help people to improve their outcomes for the future.
And so what is the relationship between outcomes then and this study of exoskeletons and their use?
So this particular study was really trying to get some background as to what were the thoughts from, actually, we had three groups. We had the clinicians, we had people who actually used robotic exoskeletons, and those who had spinal cord injury but had never used a robotic exoskeleton. So we were trying to get perspectives from those three groups as to what were the benefits, what were the things that didn't go so well. And I think it was really helpful to learn from the individuals who are involved to get that sense of what we would want to do in terms of future research using that kind of technology.
Now, it's kind of a convenient sample of who's available for you guys to more easily directly explore both user-wise and clinician-wise in this, and probably a set number, therefore, of technologies that folks were working with. What are the main exoskeletons that are reflected in this study?
So there were three main types of exoskeleton that the clinicians worked with, the brand name Exo, Indigo, and Rewalk. And in particular, we were looking for clinicians who had experience and in particular had been certified by these different companies to be able to work with patients using this kind of technology. So we wanted people who hadn't just, you know, learned about it from a book, that they actually had used the equipment and felt competent in using that equipment and having enough experience to be able to tell us about what they thought about the equipment.
And I suppose the challenge in a qualitative study like this is just trying to somewhat make it as quantitative as it is, as it can be for qualitative, to look for those trend lines and so forth, to kind of group together impressions and that type of thing. In the first place, though, I mean, what the key value of this type of study, and maybe this study in particular, what is it you're hoping that it's going to contribute to the dialogue and use of exoskeletons?
Well, I think what was really helpful for me, I didn't have experience with robotic exoskeletons. So to be able to learn from the staff that uses this equipment, actually the pros and the cons. Normally you would think, wow, this is a great technology. Everybody should be doing it. And actually there are pros and cons to it. And to be able to then make an informed decision about what you would do in terms of encouraging people with disabilities to use this, you would want to know both sides. And so I think that was really eye-opening to me, is to learn that it's not a mechanism for everybody who has a spinal cord injury. It's not a mechanism that every therapist would want to do, or is it a mechanism that people should be utilizing in their own home? So I think that there was a lot of information, certainly that I gained from doing this study, to help me learn more about what it is that we would need to do in terms of helping patients make those decisions.
I suppose some interesting parallels with kind of the expense and bother perhaps of exoskeletons and what we see perhaps in some other fields of medicine with more elective procedures and various implants and so forth, including things for, you know, tremors or cochlear implants and so forth, and like what you might expect versus what you might get, matching up those kind of consumer or patient imaginings with perhaps the marketing that's out there as well, you know, what looks potentially fantastic about it and really the reality. There seems to be a lot of that in this study, reflecting that there is a conflict perhaps a little bit between the reality and the image.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the issues that the clinicians really struggled with, is that, you know, patients might see someone else using this robot and saying, wow, this is a great thing to do, and might not be appropriate for that person, not be helpful for that person, may actually be something that might be unsafe for that person. So it's, I think that was one of the things that the clinicians struggled with a lot in terms of the expectations that patients have about this equipment and what really would be a benefit to them.
It's almost an interesting philosophical problem that for the rehab field, at least when it comes to spinal cord injury medicine and maybe increasingly brain injury as well, that some of the most the devices of greatest media interest, maybe greatest patient interest and so forth, you know, these seemingly sexy robots and so forth. I mean, it's not all wine and roses and so forth. And, it doesn't necessarily reflect the core of what we're doing in rehabilitation. It seems to be the flashiest thing that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, too, when we were working with the people that had used the robots, as well as those who knew about it but didn't really use them in the past, got some really interesting feedback as to why they wouldn't want to use it. And some of the restrictions that you have. I mean, if you have the robot, you have two things in your hand to keep you walking using the robot. That means you can't use your hands for anything else. And that was one thing I think we heard about for the future might be helpful for the manufacturer to think about ways in which they could utilize this robot without having to use both their hands, because then there's nothing else that they can do with their hands. So,
and of course, a lot of people imagine the robot, the exoskeleton, as something that's going to enable, you know, community independence and, you know, walking across that street in time and so forth. And, you know, in certain rare circumstances, but perhaps, but a lot of this study reflects the increasingly common use of these as therapy tools. You know, something that's not necessarily about your daily routine necessarily, but about enhancing the residual motor and neurological function that you do have.
Exactly. And it seems to be a great tool for the clinicians in terms of decreasing their burden in terms of helping the person with a spinal cord injury to do walking or to do other activities, because normally without a robot, you would need several therapists in order to help move the patient's legs and to be able to do the kinds of exercises that need to be done. So the robot does actually give a lot of help in terms of decreasing burden. But you're right, it's difficult to think about using it out in the community. It's not an item that someone just takes home and there you go, you have it. They have to have someone who's at home that's trained in using the equipment, someone that will be with them when their equipment, if they were to fall or to have other issues while wearing the equipment. So it hasn't moved into general use, I think, in the community. But again, those are things to think about based on these data. What would be most helpful for persons with spinal cord injury and how could they utilize these equipment in another space?
What did y'all learn about the cost barriers through this study?
So the equipment is very costly. It is available for veterans more readily than the regular population, the civilians. But in terms of there are some insurances that will help cover, some that do not cover. But it is a very costly piece of equipment. So there has to be a lot of motivation on the part of the individual who will be wearing the robot to want to continue to use it. And there are people that do use it and find a lot of benefit to it. But then you have to look at the cost versus the benefit.
Sure. What was the most surprising thing that you learned, Andrew? I know you admitted at the beginning you're a bit of a novice with regards to this type of technology. But obviously you work in the rehabilitation environment. You're familiar with them to some extent. But what would you say is probably a little bit unexpected thing that you learned?
Well, I think the one thing that stood out to me with this particular group was that it's not necessarily a device. The exoskeleton is not necessarily a device that helps people walk. I mean, it helps people maybe move around better, transfer better, maybe stand better, but not necessarily only for walking. And that to me sort of put another highlight on, you know, obviously the different types of activities you could use with a robot, which I just thought, you know, is there for walking. And so and then also thinking about what are the costs to this and in terms of the training that needs to be involved for the patient and their caregiver, what all it's helpful in terms of the burden for the therapist. So there were a lot of things I think that were really helpful learning from the clinicians in this study.
Do you think that this study will be looked at by industry? It seems like a font of information here. I would hope so. I'm sure you hope so too.
I hope so too. And we do have publications on the two other aspects. So the people with spinal cord injury that do use the or have used the exoskeleton, as well as those who do not. So hopefully between those three manuscripts that will have some impact on the industry in terms of what we asked about what would be some of the benefits, what would be some of the things you would sort of recommend to the manufacturer. So we're hoping that gets out there and things will continue to evolve over time.
Yeah, obviously you mentioned the fact that, you know, donning and doffing these devices is requiring another person and so forth will be, that alone would be a fantastic advancement if they can be minimized to the extent that the patient can handle that on their own. Dr. Ehrlich-Jones, I thank you for discussing this study with us. I think there's obviously a lot more information in here for the interested reader, and hopefully your interest has been piqued by this taste in the podcast. Exoskeletons, as we've discussed, are a highlight of rehabilitation technology. They are destined to become more practical and more useful, I feel, and hopefully studies like this will help guide that direction and further development. Not a panacea, nothing is, but a very interesting work here, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
joining us now on the Rehab Cast is Dr. John White. Dr. White will no doubt be familiar to many of our listeners as someone who has appeared with great frequency in the pages of the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, as well as I would venture to say or dare to say most rehabilitation journals. He's a long and storied career in brain injury medicine and various other areas in the rehabilitation field. Dr. White is founding director of the Moss Rehabilitation Research Institute, where he continues to serve as Institute Scientist Emeritus. Dr. White, thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So the particular paper that you're joining us on, the Rehab Cast today, concerns what I think we're going to agree through this discussion is a much needed matter in brain injury medicine, a way to properly measure functional changes and outcomes for a wide variety of needs in this population. For our audience, the title of this paper is the Brain Injury Functional Outcome Measure, BI-FOM. It is a single instrument capturing the range of recovery in moderate to severe traumatic brain injury. It has an illustrious team of co-authors, including not only Dr. White, but also Dr. Giacino and Dr. Heinemann, editor of the journal, Dr. Bodian, and many other names, including Mark Shearer, that our audience will recommend, some of whom have appeared on this podcast before. Dr. White, look forward to delving into this study with you. Let's begin at the beginning to some extent. As I presaged our audience a little bit, you have a long career in rehabilitation research and rash analysis, which we're going to discuss some as well. Really helping this field of medicine prove what it does and improve what it does. With statistical rigor, and this is part of this process as well. I imagine this is a need you have seen for some time.
Yes, that's true. Listeners will be familiar with FIM probably as the most frequently used functional outcome measure in many areas of rehabilitation, including in moderate and severe brain injury, and the benefits of that to being able to measure differences in severity between one person and another, and change in during recovery or during rehabilitation. What we knew from the traumatic brain injury model system and from many other research experiences was that when patients come into inpatient rehab, a large share of them have the lowest possible score in FIM, but they're not all the same. And when we do one year follow-up to see how people are doing, even some of the people who had the lowest possible FIM score now have the highest possible FIM score at follow-up. So the problem this causes in our study and in many other studies is that if you want to include moderate and severe patients from early after injury, when they can do little to nothing, and you want to also be able to measure variations in how well they do a long time after or after some neuroprotective treatment or almost any kind of major intervention, you run out of a ruler. You run off the edge of your measurement tool, and you either think everyone turned out the same when they maybe didn't, or you think they all started the same when they maybe didn't, and you lose a lot of precision at both points. And so over time, people have had various workarounds, like don't study people too long and then they won't change enough to fall off the end of your measurement tool, or only study people who are not recovering too fast, or only study people in a narrow severity band, and then you pick an instrument to use that works for that very specific population, but you're still quite constrained.
Part of the broader context, I mean, patients know when they're improving, families know when they're improving. We generally know to some extent as clinicians one-on-one with patients, we see the fruits of our labors and so forth. But that's all very different than attempting to test out a new rehabilitative treatment. And it's all certainly very different than what payers are going to be looking at as well.
Right. If we, you're right that we can often qualitatively describe what's changed over the course of a year, but for research purposes, we need to be able to analyze things quantitatively with some sort of numerical score. And similarly, payers want something more rigorous than clinical anecdotes. So, there are some measures. People will be familiar probably with the Glasgow Outcome Scale or Glasgow Outcome Scale Extended. Those do cover the full range of severity from unconsciousness to normal outcome, but normal recovery, but they cover them in, five or eight steps. So you have to make a huge amount of change in order to get one more point in one of those systems. And in addition, they're not what we refer to statistically as interval scales. In other words, we know that a good outcome is better than a bad outcome, but we don't know how, it's not twice as good or three times as good in any meaningful sense. So that really limits the statistical procedures we can use to analyze the data. So the FIM has good properties on the precision and interval side. In other words, we can manipulate it like a numerical value over the range that it works. And it shows fairly small changes in that range, but it's just too short to do the job for the full set of questions we have.
It has a lot of that ceiling effect as well, correct?
Ceiling and floor, right, are
both
the two. When a lot of people, ideally in any measurement tool, you want pretty much nobody to get the minimum or maximum score.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the ideal property of your measurement tool.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the challenge of launching into this. Obviously, you've got a diverse team here, but a lot of names that folks are going to recognize from the rehabilitation literature. How did you get this group together to begin with? And what were some of the different ideas about the approach to how you would go about developing the BI FOM?
Well, this was a project within the Traumatic Brain Injury Model System program that's funded by the National Institute on Disability Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. So a subgroup of the 16 centers that are part of the overall TBI model system that had interest in this particular topic collaborated on what we call a module project. The project proceeded in two phases. We agreed, all of us in one research endeavor or another had faced this problem. So we all knew it was a problem that was that existed and that was getting in all of our way and that we should solve. So then the question was how, and we decided, and what were we seeking to achieve? We wanted to, if you will, extend the bottom end of this yardstick and extend the top end, lengthen the overall measurement so that it would spread out the gradations in the very severe end and spread out the gradations in the very good recovery end, but retain the numerical measurement properties that characterize FIM and other interval scales like that. So that meant finding items that relate to the very minimal things that very severe patients can do. And on the other hand, finding things that reflect what people even better than fully independent on FIM can do. So these, when I say lower and higher, implicitly we're acknowledging that there's some dimension under here. In other words, lower on what and higher on what? Well, this dimension is arguably global neurological functioning. So we're talking about, can we measure even worse global neurological functioning than FIM does and even better? So we started by taking we had various ones of us had data sets from previous research in which we had administered FIM and or disability rating scale along with either some measure that was particularly well suited for very severely impaired patients or some measure that was very well suited for fairly high level patients. And then we analyzed those joint data sets using a technique called Roche analysis, which we can get into a little bit more later if you want, which basically asks two questions. It asks, do these other items measure the same dimension that the items you're starting with measure? And if they do, where on that yardstick do they lie? Do they lie right amidst the ones that you already have from FIM, or do they lie above those items or below those items? So from doing those, that preliminary analysis on retrospective data, we were able to identify a bunch of items that seemed to lie on the same dimension of FIM as FIM, and that seemed to be either lower or higher in this sense. But that was all based on retrospective data. So we then, and we didn't take more items that were right in the middle of the FIM items because we didn't really need them to fill in that space. So we then took a set of larger set of items and administered those prospectively to a bunch of people around the time of inpatient rehab and a bunch of people around 1 year after after injury, who were part of our model system data collection cohort, and did another wave of this kind of Roche analysis where we were able to eliminate a bunch of items that either didn't fit this dimension very well or didn't help us measurement-wise. And so that was the approach we took to end up with the BI-FOM.
So portions were delivered or assessed in person, but also some of the follow-up took place over the telephone as well. The entire measure can be done over the telephone, is that correct?
Well, the yes and no. That is, the there are a few items that sample the most severe gradations of functioning that require clinician examination because they have to do with whether someone follows commands or not, which is, we don't think that untrained people can reliably make those decisions all the time and so on. The Roche analysis, our statistical technique, is very forgiving of missing data. So when someone can do something higher level than follow a command, like if I'm interviewing you on the phone and you're answering questions, I don't care whether you can follow a command or not, because we're way above that level of the scale. So it only becomes a problem for people who are at the very low end, most of whom are inpatients when they're being when you're collecting data. So the people we would, for whom it's a total problem, are the people who remain vegetative at 1 year, let's say, who I might not be certain are vegetative or minimally conscious, but I will certainly know that they're at the low end of the scale.
So you utilized the other measures as part of the Roche analysis in order to correlate each of the new measures. I mean, looking at the FIM, the Coma Recovery Scale, and outcome scales and so forth. But is there a direct comparison of saying how well the new measure does versus those others?
Well, just to slightly shift what you said, it's not it's not that we're comparing these. We are ultimately comparing the performance of the BI-FOM to the performance of FIM. Okay. As a way to answer the question of, did we succeed in our goals? But BI-FOM has a number of FIM items in it. So it's when we're saying, what are the properties of the BI-FOM? It's what are the properties of the items that were drawn from all these other measures that ended up in this collection that we're now calling BI-FOM. So as you say, some came from the Coma Recovery Scale revised, some came from the Disability Rating Scale, some came from some cognitive telephone cognitive assessment batteries, and so on. And individual items from those other measures end up marking different points on this yardstick. And then we don't use the other, we don't use the whole FIM, we don't use the whole whatever the cognitive battery was, et cetera, et cetera. We use these specific questions or items. That makes sense.
Now that you've analyzed a reasonable number of patients, both acutely and post and 1 year follow up surveys, a total of 184, received what looks like quality information about their functional status through the BIFOM, what remains to be done in order to say, you know what, let's go ahead and make this a standard going forward? Is there further proof that is required next, or is it time to begin some implementation studies?
Yes, that's a good question. And there is a little bit more work that we think needs to be done before we want to recommend using this in research or in program evaluation or whatever broadly. Two things really need to be done. One is that for anything like this, it's where you select your items based on analysis from one specific set of research participants. You want to make sure that if you now administer that measure to a new set of research participants, it performs as well, or actually probably almost as well, because it almost never performs exactly as well, because some of the wellness of its performance was tailored to the idiosyncrasies of that particular sample and won't be true in the next one. So that's kind of what you have to establish to make sure it still looks good with a new sample. Secondly, there are some sort of practical and quasi-legal issues. So as listeners probably know, the FIM has gone out of existence as a routinely collected billing-related entity. So we were able for this study to simply retrieve FIM items from the clinical data system. The clinical data system handled training and certifying its practitioners to know how to do FIM assessment and so on and so forth. So we will have to modify the items that came from FIM to be interview-based. We think that that's doable because we already have a FIM-based interview for 1 year follow-up that has been validated and works pretty well. We haven't ever used it to interview clinicians, which is what you'd have to do on the inpatient side. Secondly, since these items came from a number of other sources, many of those sources are in the public domain, but some are proprietary. And so there will be the question of getting authorization to take parts, but not all of other measures and incorporate them into this.
I see. So. Yeah, those legalistic aspects. That is a challenge in this world. And then the implementation of getting someone like CMS to encourage its use and so forth. Do you have any insight into the move from CMS away from the FIM and how that decision occurred since we're talking about it?
I'm not an expert on this. I think you have to distinguish whether a measure is being used as an outcome measure or, if you will, as a case mix severity indicator. In other words, am I wanting to know how well you did, or I'm wanting to know how challenging it is to care for you and how much help you need? Many of these measures serve both purposes to some degree. We often use FIM at admission as a severity indicator of who's coming in the door, right? But we also use it as an outcome measure to say how well did the person recover. So I think CMS, because they're about payment, prioritizes the use as a case mix indicator. And they were able to convince themselves that a smaller set of items and actually items that fall more on the motor and self-care side, not as heavily on the cognitive side, would do the job for them. I don't think they were expecting to be mandating an instrument that would help us figure out the efficacy and effectiveness of rehabilitation services necessarily.
Sure. Yeah. And of course, the challenge is that we can certainly go above and beyond what Medicare or other payers require. And it's up to, perhaps organizations like CARF and ACRM and so forth, other certifying bodies to encourage that as kind of a standard. And but yeah, always interested in the advocacy angles with regards to the quality of care research that's being done in the journal, an important piece. Obviously, as you state, more work does remain to be done a bit still on the prove it angle, but it looks like that should come in the near term. And again, this is a desperately needed change. We're all too familiar with these measures such as the FEM not reflecting the week by week changes that we're seeing or month by month in our patient population. So
I think that the biggest impact, frankly, will not necessarily be in clinical monitoring, because whether it will be practical to administer this. It's not a terribly time-consuming, but it's not something you can rate in 5 minutes. So I think what this will be most useful for, at least initially, is, for example, in neuroprotection trials that are currently using good outcome, bad outcome dichotomy to measure the impact of whatever early intervention, this allows them to enroll the full sample of severity and measure their outcome with a numerically graded measure as opposed to good, bad. And similarly for all kinds of other research studies where we're wanting to quantify the impact of outcome over either some decent period of time or a wide spectrum of severity.
Yeah, I agree. It has been painful over the years. I mean, amazing quality science being done, basic neuroscience, advanced neurosurgery, implants, and so forth. And then the functional outcome is like, well, you got, four or five ordinal points. It's like, well, dang, I'm not really sure what this does. So,
right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for spending the time with us, Dr. White, explaining this important work that you and your team have done. Obviously, encourage the listeners of the podcast to delve into the pages of the journal for the article and the supplements as well. And hopefully this has been an enlightening interview for you all. It certainly has for me. Thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
And that does it for the April 2021 Rehabcast from your favorite rehabilitation medicine journal. Be sure to circulate the podcast to your colleagues. Remember, every like and share increases the size of Atlanta's media market. All right, enough, I know. Please tune in next month.